They say you should never ask a man whether he's humble. You should always ask the neighbors, and I feel the same way about being asked to share my story this morning. I wish someone else was telling my story, but I'll try to do my best. I was born and raised in a little community called Nazareth. Small little community, a village actually, about 300 people living there, so everybody knew each other. I was born and raised into the traditional Jewish family. So, because an earlier Jewish queen had decreed that all Jewish boys were to be literate so that they could read and study the Torah, I was one of those people who had been educated in that way. I think it was highly educated for men of my time, but not for the men of my culture. I'd like to think of myself as being a gentle soul, slow to speak, slow to anger. As a man who felt humbled, I think, just by the mere fact that I was given an occupation like carpentry. My village, as I said, being small, most of us would have been farmers, but there were a few craftspeople. And having been raised in the craft of carpentry, that is a job that required extra measure of skills, and we had lots of work. We had a good livelihood, and a lot of that work would have taken me outside of Nazareth, probably a fairly large community called Sepphoris, which was sort of one of King Herod's capital cities, and I had a lot of work there. I got my training at my father's knee, and I apprenticed under my father, and for a while I worked for my father, and then our roles reversed, and he was working for me. I was betrothed to Mary. She was a lot younger than I was, but that was also very normal for that time. I was looking forward to the day that we would be married. And I was having a good life. But up until this point, I would say, if you want to sum up my life, it could simply be said I was an ordinary Joe living in Nazareth. But then something happened. One afternoon, a young messenger boy ran up into my shop and said, Mary would like to talk to you. And I says, well, return the message and say, once I close up shop today, I'll come and see her. My heart was racing a little faster, I must admit. I mean, I didn't know much about Mary other than how I met her in the community and saw her. She was a young, beautiful woman, seemed like a very devout, sincere girl. I was looking forward to her becoming my wife. And I never got to talk to her much, as the custom of the time, you didn't spend time talking. This was her encounters in the village. And now that I was being summoned to Mary's home, I assumed that there would be some family member around, either within eyesight or earshot of what was going to be taking place. But I was still excited with the opportunity of being able to see Mary. And so when I went into her courtyard that evening, I was surprised to see her alone. I still assumed family was somewhere within shot, eyesight or earshot, even though I couldn't see them or hear them. And I walked up to Mary. I says, I understand you wanted to see me. And she says, yes, I have something to tell you. And she says, Joseph, just want to let you know that I'm pregnant. And my world seemed to come to an end. My heart didn't skip a beat. I think it stopped beating. And she kept on talking, but I was just, my sweet, innocent Mary is telling me she's pregnant. And I was having a hard time breathing, but somewhere she kept talking and I picked up this thing, but don't worry, it's no man, it's God's child. And I'm like, oh my God. That was like being slapped now in the face. First you tell me you're pregnant, and I know one thing for certain, it isn't, I'm not the father. That's the one thing I'm certain of. And now you have the audacity to slap me in the face by saying, oh, don't worry, it's nobody's child except God's child. Like, how many times have you heard that line before? I don't remember the next moments much, except that fortunately my character stood in my stead. I didn't do or say anything that I would later have to regret, but I remember slowly turning on my heels and leaving the courtyard. And as I stumbled my way home, I stopped numerous times on the side of the road and retched because my stomach was churning. I had I had never experienced that kind of a situation before. And so I stumbled through the curtained entranceway into my room, and that evening and late into the night, I wrestled with myself and I wrestled with God and I prayed. I've always been, I think, a fairly devout man. I was a man of God. I tried to obey God's laws, but I must admit my life was in turmoil. And somewhere in that whole struggle, I did fall asleep. But before I did, I was trying to envision what Mary had told me. Knowing what I knew about Mary, I could not see how there could have been any other man in that village that Mary would have betrayed me with. That didn't make sense. That didn't add up to her character. But having said that, living close to a larger center, Roman soldiers passed through on a regular basis through our town. And seeing Mary as being a rather young and naive girl, and knowing a little bit about the lives of Roman soldiers, and I know what men, women do with men in uniform, I thought, well, if anything makes sense, maybe that's a possibility. And I could understand that, and I could even accept that. But that she would have the audacity to lie to me and say, it's no man's child, it's God's child. That was insult to injury. But I fell asleep, battling with that, and wondering, what's the right thing to do? I mean, if I marry her, Mary's reputation is ruined in the sense that I know that I'm not the father of a child. So what do I do if Mary goes around and says, he's not the father because God is the father of this child? It doesn't matter even if I believe that. Who else is going to believe this story? How is that even possible? So they're going to view Mary as being very far less than holy. The child could be illegitimate. And really, I'm thinking she should marry the father of that child, whoever that father. That would be the right thing to do. But I don't know. And then my ordinary life had another unusual experience, because that night I had a dream. And that dream was as vivid as if it really happened. God's messenger Gabriel came to me. And he says to me, Joseph, I want to let you know that Mary is pregnant. And I'm like, yeah, I know that. And he says, by the way, it's nobody else's child but God's. And I'm like, whoa. That blew me away. He just said virtually the same thing that Mary had just said to me earlier that evening. And then he was gone. Aside from telling me that I should take Mary to be my wife, as had been planned, and that I should call him Jesus. And he just vanished. I woke up, trying to figure whether that was a real thing or whether it was a dream. But anyway, I had a new dilemma, because God's messenger had just uttered the same words Mary had uttered to me, and I had thought she was being unfaithful and had lied to me. But from my experience with Yahweh, Yahweh had never lied to me. So if I didn't believe Mary, that meant God was lying to me through the messenger. And if God doesn't lie, then Mary doesn't lie. Then she told me the truth. But I mean, really, God is the father of my child? Even if I want to believe that, how likely is that? But something told me that there was something about Mary's character that I should believe what I had been told, because she seemed to be a God-fearing woman. And she wouldn't have done this to me with any reason that she would have done this on purpose. there would have been a logical reason for what had taken place. And so I decided God and Mary were telling me the truth, hard as it was to believe. And then I took Mary to be my wife. She gave birth to a beautiful little baby boy, and I did name him Jesus. And then a little while later, got the same messenger appear in a dream again. He says, your life and Mary's and Jesus is in danger. You better go to Egypt. I had believed the last message. I believed this one, and I followed through. And sure enough, not long after we arrived in Egypt, news got through that it was a good thing we had left. And you know, that still niggling little doubt in the back of mind about whether Mary was carrying God's child diminished just a little bit more, because God had once again, through his messenger, given me a story that I could believe. And a while later, I got another vision from God saying it is now safe to come back, and I should bring back my child and my family. And he told me which route I should take. And with the experiences I had had with Yahweh's messengers till now, I believed that message and I came home. And once again, with that message proving right, that still niggling little doubt in the back of my mind that that might not be God's child diminished even more, because God was being truthful to me. So, my life changed from being an ordinary Joe to one whose life was turned upside down when Jesus came into my life. My prayer for you is that Jesus will have the same impact on your life as he did on mine.
Just sit down again and just tell you that it's over. Let's bow for prayer. Lord, open your word to our hearts and our hearts to your words. Amen. I should actually have Elaine up here modeling her t-shirt, but in 1939, just before the British declared war against Hitler's Germany, a public relations campaign developed the slogan, "Keep calm and carry on." I don't know if you've ever seen that shirt or that little slogan or a version of it, but it's appeared all over the Western world in the last number of years. And the focus of our message this morning concerns a man who receives little attention in the scriptures, but is mentioned both for what he and who, for what he does and for who he is, but not much for what he says. As I think of the character of Joseph in the biblical birth narratives, I'm reminded of this little phrase, "keep calm and carry on," in describing his role and significance in the Jesus story. So we've heard Doug describe who Joseph is. And it's very much to what Scripture says, with a little understanding attached in what some of the texts around Joseph would say was common to that era. Joseph was an artisan, a carpenter, a tecton in Greek, a descendant of David, the greatest king of Israel, betrothed but not yet married to Mary, a young woman, perhaps more of a girl than a woman at this point. Joseph received a vision from God in which he was told of Mary's pregnancy, that it was of God, that he should take her as his wife and not quietly divorce her, that the son she was carrying was special, and that this son would save people from their sins. And finally, that Joseph should name him Jesus, or the Anointed One. And as Doug described, Joseph took Mary to be his wife, but didn't actually unite sexually with her until after the birth of Jesus, so the scriptures tell us. We read again of Joseph when we hear that he and his wife, who's pregnant this time, go to Bethlehem because a census is being called for by Caesar, Augustus, and everyone was supposed to go to their home or their the village or the town or their community from which their line came from. So they go to Bethlehem, and there Jesus was born close to Jerusalem, where he was subsequently circumcised. Later on, we read again in Matthew of the visit of these Eastern potentates, the Magi, visiting Jesus' family, looking to see the King of the Jews. We're then told that Joseph receives a dream, is asked to take his family, Jesus and Mary, to Egypt, to remain there until he was directed otherwise. And there they did, until it was safe to return to Judea, and there they moved back to Nazareth, Joseph's hometown, where they lived until Jesus began his ministry. And that's the end of the Joseph story. We don't hear of him again, except for one little time, where it says that he and Mary took Jesus to the temple when Jesus was 12 years old, perhaps for his bar mitzvah, where he became a man. But there they proceed to lose him. And it says that Mary ultimately found him sitting with the elders, the priests, having a good old-fashioned chinwag about points of detail about the Torah. There are only a few people who could get enjoyment from that. He's lost for a couple of days. And that's it for Joseph. But I want to put it to you this way, that Joseph's place in the biblical story is terribly important. It's important for several reasons. First of all, it has great theological significance. The great Swiss theologian Karl Barth asserted that of all the central beliefs about Christian faith, there's none more important than the one of the virgin birth. Why? Why this one? Well, the problem is that the incarnation is one of those incredibly difficult points of understanding about the Christian faith, which is mentioned but not really understood or accepted by many. What is the incarnation? Well, the early church had a problem with this. They couldn't figure out what it meant for Jesus to be both God and human. And they devised many ways trying to articulate this point. There were some who said that Jesus was not truly human. Or as they might put it, if you let Jesus walk on the sand, he wouldn't leave any footprints. He was heavenly. He perhaps floated just lightly over the surface of the earth, the Docetists. Or there were the adoptionists, those who believed that Jesus was adopted by God later on, either at his baptism or at the crucifixion or even the resurrection. Or even like the Arians, that Jesus was created by the Father. He wasn't eternal or co-eternal with God the Father. Orthodoxy, if you will, won out. And so, if you look at the Creed of St. Athanasius, you'll find this statement, which became the doctrine of the church. Now, the right faith is that we believe and confess that our Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is both God and man. He is God of the substance of the Father begotten before the worlds, and he is man of the substance of his mother born in the world. Perfect God, perfect man, of reasoning soul and human flesh subsisting, who, although he may be God and man, yet he is not two, but is one Christ. So you have the paternity of God and yet the humanity of Mary brought into one. And that's how we come to believe that Jesus Christ is the very incarnation, the enfleshment of God on earth. And that is still what the church believes to this day. And so the story of Joseph is important precisely because of the way it describes how Jesus arose, how he came to be, and how he fits into who we believe Jesus is. So he fits, and he is described, or Joseph is described, as having a role very important to who Jesus is and how we understand him today. But that's a little arcane, perhaps. Maybe that's a little beyond us or the kind of depth we want to think. There are some other more human reasons why I think the story has great significance for us. Joseph's description in the story has great ethical and moral significance. There's nothing exceptional about Moses. I think, Doug, you played it perfectly. You and I could have talked about this and we would have read our stories exactly the same way. Joseph isn't the heroic type. He's not a warrior. He's not a gifted person in any noticeable way. He has talents. But he's a dependable, obedient, devout man, desirous of doing the right thing, and sympathetic to others. He would be somebody you would be proud to know. And whenever you thought about somebody you would trust with your life, that would be Joseph. He chose not to accuse Mary of adultery, which would have occasioned her execution. Rather, he was going to put her away, it says. He's going to get a petition for divorce over some unmentioned shortcoming, which would allow her the freedom to find another partner. He took care of his family. He moved them to Egypt when he was warned of danger, and then moved back when he could, and the danger was past. And Joseph wasn't the person who looked for the limelight. Joseph did his duty. He was content to be a part of the supporting cast. He did what he could and what he should. He obeyed the prompting of the angel, but not more than he should. He didn't try to do more than he could. See, Joseph was a man of integrity. He had both personal standards and compassion for others, and he did what was right and what was best for others, and one never gets the sense that he was a vindictive or a difficult person. He worked hard. He provided for his family. He took care of his family and did his best. So he was a solid character. As Doug said, he was the strong, silent type. It doesn't record one word that Joseph ever said. He listened. He just listened. But then as I thought about this story in the light of the world in which I find myself, and perhaps you do as well, I thought there's another really important lesson for me and perhaps for us as well. A few years ago, I read this humorous but eloquent little book called The Gardener's Year by a Czech intellectual statesman named Karel Čapek. I don't know why I read it. I just happened to order it from Amazon because I saw it and I thought it was really neat. And I found it one of the most incredible little books I've ever bought and read. It was a reflection on human nature, but from a gardener's perspective. In it, he would say things like, "It is the winter, in the winter that the most important work of the gardener occurs." Did you know that? Doug probably did, but I didn't. From ordering seeds to taking care of the garden to letting the garden rest and renew itself. He says, you know, you look at the surface of the garden and nothing seems to be happening. He says, you just go underneath and it's just a beehive of activity. I thought of this as I reflected on the past year with all of the surprises that many of us have had, the sorrows, the dangers, the fears, the foreboding sense of despair felt by so many with respect to climate change, politics, wars and famines, the losses of jobs, rising prices perhaps, the growing deficit, and we could go on. And then I think of when Advent happens. Advent in the Northern Hemisphere happens at the darkest time of the year. By now, the sun sets well before 5. Night is way longer than daytime. And we're approaching the shortest daytime in the calendar year. If you look at the set Advent readings for today, for the third Sunday of Advent, the prophets there speaking in the form of Isaiah in chapter 35 were not fooled by the apparent stability of their corrupt and imperial powers. But the prophets then sought always to try to arouse the anesthetized people who lived in a fool's paradise, blissfully ignorant of the dangers gathering on the horizon. They're asking the populace, don't you see? Don't look at the surface of things. Look underneath. What is really happening? In one of the Advent texts set for the third week of Advent, in Isaiah 35, the prophet calls Israel to see clearly what is going on and then to imagine a different world in which God's good future of justice and well-being for all creation, people, plants, everything, will be the reality. Joseph was like that. He rested on the promise that God's good work was going to go forward, no matter what the dangers around it were. He had heard the angel giving him directives for the family. Herod was a cruel and vicious king, and if you ever read anything about Herod, you'll find that, yeah, the nickname was the Great, was kind of given to himself by himself. He was an evil man. He had his wife, his mother, all killed because he saw them as threats to the throne. The land was relatively quiet, but there were already the seeds of rebellion against the occupying empire. Messiahs were springing up, promising freedom and independence. Strange signs were being witnessed in the sky, and yet Joseph doggedly follows God's directives regardless of the cost. He doesn't say, excuse me, can't I just go across the border over here, maybe? Why all the way to Egypt? Joseph just gets on with it. The other Advent texts that we would read this Sunday would speak of the healing of the blind, the deaf, the lame, the mute, the leper. They would speak of justice for the oppressed, food for the hungry, freedom for prisoners, hope for the beaten down, protection for the strangers, widows, and orphans. And in Matthew 11, we might read of new life for the dead and good news for the poor. And yet I look around me and I ask, where is this reality prophesied so many years ago? I think of the latest album by Leonard Cohen, where he sings, if you're the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you're the healer, it means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker. We kill the flame. It's a song that complains to God about the state of the world, about the state of self, and yet it's a lament about our inhumanity of humans to other humans, all at the same time. We look at the beauty and the brokenness of our world simultaneously, and perhaps we tend to despair of the things that may be coming. But not Joseph. Not Joseph. Joseph represents for me the importance of living with integrity during the time one has and in the circumstances one is given. In this little book by Chopic, he recounts this little story about this American who came to this Englishman and said, you know, can you tell me how you get your lawns so wonderfully green and rich? I'd like to do that back at my home. So the Englishman says, sure, I'll tell you. He says, first of all, you take some good soil, you make sure it's nice and fertile, then you seed it, and then you weed it, and then you water it, and then you cut it, and you do that all over again, and again, and you do that for 300 years, and then you'll have a lawn like mine. I think Joseph had the long view in mind. It wasn't about him. He was an important part of history, but he wasn't history. Perhaps like Joseph, we observe the coming one in the midst of growing darkness. A darkness that increases not unlike the winter solstice and the darkness we create for ourselves and for others. But maybe this morning, when we see the light of the third candle, we can try to sing with gladness and try to practice the hardest text we'll hear as we gather with others to pray. The words of the Apostle James in our last Advent reading that I'll mention, set for the third Advent Sunday in this year, which goes, see how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. It'll come. Don't give up hope. Wait expectantly, keeping calm and carrying on.